No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. We have a lot to talk about tonight. Maria, welcome. Are you there?
I am. Good afternoon and good evening. Good afternoon. Welcome to our listeners, who we are very grateful for, who make the time to take a listen to our program.
Thank you. Couldn't have been said more graciously. And that we'll talk about graciousness later in the show, because it's Courtesy Week, among other things. Courtesy Week, Earth Days today. We've got a whole bunch of new co-signers. But before we get into all that, we also have a special guest with us tonight, Dr. David Schwartzman. Dr. Schwartzman is a great guy. He's an activist here in Washington. I've known him for years. He's professor emeritus of chemistry. He was a chemistry professor at Howard University, and we're so happy to have him. Great guy, good friend. Welcome to the show. David, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you, Michael and Maria. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. Let me make a small correction. I'm Professor Emeritus from the Department of Biology.
My specialty
has been geochemistry and biogeochemistry.
Can you explain to us what geochemistry and biogeochemistry is?
From the parts of the word, it's the interface between chemistry and geology, and biogeochemistry, you include biology. So, for example, the carbon cycle that's so important to climate change is really an area of research for biogeochemistry, the biogeochemical cycle of carbon.
I have done
research on that.
My father used to say, it's better to be lucky than good, and how lucky to have a biogeochemist on Earth Day. So maybe we should start there before we get into other things. How are we doing on the Earth as far as global warming and climate change goes, Dr. Schwartzman?
I'm very concerned about where we are globally. The Paris Agreement was very important, but you know that the guy in the White House now got us out of the agreement. And that was a very bad move. Although I'm optimistic that the growing global movement to have more aggressive curb on climate carbon emissions, which is key to preventing climate catastrophe, is ongoing, and it's gaining strength. It's certainly, I think, gaining strength in the United States as well as elsewhere in the world. So I remain an optimist, although we have huge challenge to confront, not only curbing carbon emissions, but changing our mode of agriculture to a more ecologically sustainable agriculture, and, of course, accelerating the implementation of wind and solar energy globally.
Yeah. Speaking of solar, what does the tariffs with the Chinese and the solar, how do you think that's going to play out?
Well, it's the solar industry here was very against the tariff. But in the end, I think it's only a temporary setback. I think that knowledgeable people will prevail. And the momentum for building wind and solar around the world is gaining much more strength. The real challenge is to curb the use of fossil fuels, starting with the worst ones, which are coal and natural gas. It turns out natural gas is really bad because it leaks directly to the atmosphere, and methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. And that's why the actions around the world and in the U.S. against these pipelines are so important. I view natural gas as extreme energy, which needs to be curbed.
Well, let me tell you what I'm doing.
Let me just say that in D.C., we have a pretty vibrant move towards renewable, but it could be even stronger. And I don't know if listeners know that our mayor, along with, I guess, almost 200 mayors around the country last June, signed on to a resolution to pledge to implement 100% renewable energy by 2035. 2035. This is more aggressive than Sustainable DC plan, which I participated in the working groups, including the first and then the recently concluded one.
Well, yeah, we're very proud of our efforts here in the District of Columbia. I was actually with the mayor when she signed another resolution to adhere to the Paris Accords, even though we backed out.
Yes.
So we're proud of that. And I can tell you, as a father, what I'm doing to help the environment is I'm walking around the house saying to my kids, who lecture me all the time about global warming, turn the lights out when you're not in the room.
Yes.
You know, so everything any of us can do to help that, we really want to do. And it's a real problem. You know, we're seeing it here in Washington, right, David? 80 degrees on Tuesday, snow on Thursday. I mean, the climate is changing. If
you did you really?
Today, and I went jogging in Rutgers Park.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that. Let me just say, mention that my oldest son, Peter, and I are coming out with a book in a few months, which discusses in systematically climate change, energy transition, and eco-socialism. You have identified me correctly as an eco-socialist, and what that means is understanding that 21st century socialism, democratic socialism, can only be viable if the environment, the ecology, is taken full into account. And our book is entitled The Earth is Not for Sale, The Path from Fossil Capitalism to the Other World that is Still Possible.
Well, we'll anxiously await your putting the book out, and I'd love to read it, and we'll have to have you and your son back on the show to talk about it, because I think
he lives in Galesburg, Illinois, so maybe you can kind of Skype in.
But yeah,
sure.
I'm anxious to actually discuss some of my testimony. I've been testifying to the council now for nearly 20 years on issues which concern the budget. I've been a member of the Fair Budget Coalition for many years and active in not only that group, but 1DC and Power DC. And I would be happy to discuss some what I think are some of the real challenges we face in D.C. as far as the quality of life.
Improving
the quality of life of our residents.
Sure.
Go ahead. What do you think is the most important thing? Sorry to talk
about it. I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, go ahead, David. Explain to us what we need to do in the district. What is your testimony?
Okay, this is, I testified in March on the comprehensive plan. But what I did, we're not getting into the comprehensive plan right now. What I did was sort of lay out what the reality is in D.C. And this is also informed by my long-term participation in the D.C. Human Rights City Steering Committee, which the early phase has got D.C. being the first human rights city in the United States officially. And so we've held our elected government accountable for implementing those that commitment. So here's the realities that I see. One, D.C. has the highest income inequality in the nation compared to the 50 states. That means the biggest gap between the rich and the poor. It has a huge racial wealth inequality as well. Homelessness per capita, that is per population in D.C., is the highest in the nation of any city. We have a big life expectancy disparity. Black males live about 15 years less, almost 15 years less than white, and black females live 9 years less than white in D.C. We have a child poverty level that is very high. As a matter of fact, it's just slightly lower than Mississippi. And, of course, we are aware of the lack of affordable housing, which affects actually more than majority of D.C. residents, and that's well documented. That is, people are paying more than 30% of their income for housing, whether they're renters or homeowners, but especially renters. And finally, and this was highlighted in an editorial, very nice editorial in the Washington Post. I don't often praise the Washington Post. But the editorial today said there's a maternal mortality crisis, and which mainly affects black women, of course. And they conclude that the inequity in the healthcare delivery system for many women of color and low income residents is of real concern. Access to preventive and prenatal care. So these are the realities we face. Well, going beyond, and I'm a radical.
No.
You haven't detected that already. Radical means going to the root. So actually, as I've gotten older, I've gotten more radical. And so what is the root of these problems? And I hold our elected government accountable for not doing better in addressing these challenges. And we do have a tax base to do so. And it's not being tapped. In other words, and this is also, Senator Brown, relates to our struggle for statehood. Our elected government has not pushed the limits of home rule. And that means utilizing legally what we're able to do under the Home Rule Charter, and that is to revise our tax structure to make it progressive and more capable of funding the needs that are unmet right now. And that's really documented in the Fair Budget budget recommendations for 2019. And I invite listeners to go to the website and see in detail what is being proposed. And let me just say that we have had a policy of trickle-down economics and trickle-down housing. And unfortunately, this has been the legacy of a lobby that's very powerful in D.C., and many listeners have heard of it. It's called the Federal City Council. This is an unelected body, which is basically a lobby of the big banks and big developers. And the realities that I've listed are really the legacy of this agenda. Some call it the neoliberal agenda that's mainly used in Europe, but trickle-down economics is another description. And so,
let me just interject here.
Okay, I'll stop. I went on.
Well, I mean, for what you say is very much true. And when we talk about healthcare, for example, in District of Columbia, the city is divided into four quadrants and eight wards. And in my ward, we have three of the top hospitals in the country. But in Ward 7 and Ward 8, in both wards, we have one hospital. It's not a good hospital. It's going under. It's under a lot of pressure right now because it can't sustain itself. And there are also lots and lots of scandals connected to it. So healthcare in Washington is, you know, there's a desperate a difference between whether you live in the rich part of the city or the poor side of the city. So,
That's very true.
Wait a second, David. Yes. Also, as a politician, yes, I will tell you that Ward 7 and Ward 8 has the lowest voter participation in Washington, D.C. So we got to get people out to vote. And that's one of the reasons, I think, you know, there's certainly racial reasons and other reasons involved, but there's also the reason of the people in Northwest go out to the polls and the people in Southeast, unfortunately, don't as much. And so politicians don't listen to them as much.
What do you have? Do you know how many folks are registered versus how many vote, Michael?
Yeah, about a little over 50% of us vote. A little over 50% of the registered voters in the District of Columbia, the nation's capital, the place that brags about democracy, a little over 50% of the voters vote. I can't remember if it's 53 or 54, but it's a horrible amount, you know. I think that everybody should, if you're not sick or you don't have a job interview that day, or you ought to be out there voting. And what people don't understand about voting sometimes, Maria, is that politicians look at who votes, whether you elect the person or not. You know what I mean? If you're not out there, every time you don't vote, you not only sell yourself short, you sell everybody in your group short. If you're a woman, you sell women short. If you're young, you sell young people short. If you're old, you sell old people short, because they look at those statistics. And that's why old people get more than young people, because they vote more.
They're more active. But what about in the wards that you just mentioned that have those terrible conditions? Are they registered to vote? And do they vote?
Yes. No. Yes, lower voter participation, even lower than the 50% mark.
I think that's true, but part of the reason is that many low-income people don't see much change in their condition. So there's a feeling of demoralization, and this is also reflected, I think, in polls even before the vote on the Constitution. You know, back in November 2016, there were polls that indicate the weakest support for statehood was really among low-income folk, because the feeling was, okay, we're going to elect, if we get it become a state, we'll have the same people we have now. So that's why I think pushing the limits of home rule, and home rule is a shackle. It's a colonial shackle. The way to break a shackle is to push against it and smash it. And that's to empower the statehood movement and to empower the struggles for economic, social, and environmental justice. That will empower the movement and, I think, bring a lot more people to the polls because they'll feel there's a reason to vote. I would think that... there is, though, a real opportunity to be considered now that I hope the council takes very seriously. I've had conversations with some council people on this. We have an opportunity to put a major boost of funding into low-income programs, and that would include expanding public housing, repairing and expanding public housing, income support. Do you know that temporary assistance for needy families, the income level that is going into effect in 2019 would be 36% of the federal poverty level. Do you know that white kids in New Hampshire are getting 60% of the federal poverty level?
Yeah.
There's certainly a racial justice issue here. And I think that with the council, I think the council should boost the income support, and this would have a major impact on the quality of life of children and their families, because child poverty has huge negative impacts on not only their families, a child's future, but the whole community. And this is, by the way, this is a really good report that was put out by DC Fiscal Policy Institute by Kate Coventry on this issue. And I invite listeners to actually go to that website and read it. It's very well documented, but these are things DC government can do, but where's the money? And here I just want to take this opportunity to outline an opportunity which is really unprecedented. And that's actually due as a result of the unwelcome Trump tax cut legislation, which gives most of the tax cut to wealthy folk. Now, this is in the federal income tax. And in 2019... we have a study by ITEP, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, which shows that residents in D.C. who are earning more than $200,000 a year, $200,000 a year and above, will get a tax cut from the federal, in their federal income tax, of over $250 million. And so here's an opportunity for D.C., to a D.C. council and mayor to approve a budget which includes a tax hike for the same residents. And we're talking about modestly raising the D.C. income tax rate on these wealthy residents and equalize the federal tax cut with a increase in revenue to D.C. In other words, we can recover this tax cut by raising the D.C. income tax rate and leaving these taxpayers paying the same overall taxes before. This is
a lot of revenue
that we can use very wisely to improve the quality of life, especially of our low-income residents.
Well, let me steal Maria's thunder a little bit here and play the Republican. We already have a budget of $14 billion for this small city, David. $14 billion. It's got to be something more than just money. It's got to be the way we deliver services, doesn't it? Because we already spend $14 billion and we're not getting the job done. We've got the lowest, we're 50 out of 51 in school systems, for example, even though we spend $25,000 per student in the District of Columbia. So there's got to be a way that we're not delivering the services properly. Not that we shouldn't, you know, tax people that make tremendous amounts of money, but it can't just be about money, right, Maria?
Well, yes. It is a lot about money. Let me just emphasize, it's not only the lack of progressivity and our local tax structure above family income of about $50,000, and that means that millionaires are paying a lower rate than working class folk. But it's also the huge tax subsidies that comes out of our revenue that's in the budget, right? That comes out of our revenue and goes to subsidize the building of condos and very high-priced apartments, and these are subsidized. This is gentrification, and the result has been for the last over a decade the displacement of long-term residents, mainly black residents. So it's gentrification and displacement. That is why we have a crisis of affordability in housing in D.C. where most residents can't pay all their bills. They have to sacrifice one bill for another, and this is a really bad situation. So we need to curb these subsidies, transfer this money to where it's really needed, and also to adjust our tax structure. And you need to look at detail at where the money is going. Yes, we have a very big budget, but let me mention that I heard briefings by both the mayor's budget office, Jenny Reed, and also Jennifer Budoff from the council budget office. So I've seen the data and question these representatives of city government. And it's apparent that the money is, as you said, it's not used as effectively as it should be. We need to put it in programs that I think have the most impact. And I would submit that I gave an example. The income support level for TANF is going to be only 36% of the federal poverty level. This is leaving over 30,000 children in poverty in D.C., mainly Black children, and it's very high, of course, poverty level east of the river, especially in Ward 8. So we can make a major impact, I think, by putting the money in the right place. And it's not only income support, it's the whole group of services and programs that bring people into productive activity in the workforce and so on. It's adult literacy, it is mental health and substance abuse treatment and so forth. You know, rich people, if they have a substance abuse problem, they have all these clinics they can afford to go to. Poor people, yes, there are services, but then the challenge is to how do we pay child care to take care of the kids? How am I going to meet my obligations for TANF by going to apply for work at the same time? This is a crisis, I would think, and I've talked to people in this situation, and this is a crisis of everyday living that people are facing, and we have to be realistic about how we can confront this, but certainly not give up and take the attitude, well, there'll always be poor people, it's their own fault.
Not.
I know, but you're not saying that, but there are people, I think, in the listening audience who kind of write off poor people, and this is part of the Trump ideology, of course, that got him a support of a lot of white folk who took the attitude that people on welfare are no good and lazy. This is an ideology which actually divides people in the working class and the so-called middle class. And then the big corporate sector can keep on making more and more profit and at the expense of everyone else. And I'm not
against
profit.
Okay, David, wait a second.
But the income and wealth inequality in this country and in D.C. in particular has grown to extraordinary proportions.
Right. Well, that may be true. David, hold on just one second. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have this brilliant co-host, and I want to give her an opportunity to ask you a question if she wants to.
Thank you. I did. Yeah. And I appreciate your passion. The reason I've been quiet is I didn't want to interrupt. But I'm curious, because the beginning of your conversation with us was the exact numbers that I was told by my friend who's the medical director at the fire department, with the fire department there in Washington, D.C., who just rolled out this plan this week for y'all. And it's so depressing, the numbers. And he talked to me about the life expectancy that you shared, and et cetera. Is there hope in any way, shape, or form? I mean, it's distressing what you just shared.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, I think there's hope. Definitely there's hope. Let me tell you where the hope is. And it's always been with organizations, collective efforts of people fighting back in their own interests. That's where the hope is. And that's why I'm a member of 1DC and Empower DC and the Grassroots Planning Coalition, because these are folk from around the city who are addressing the challenges that I mentioned. And let's go back to the 60s. I was a grad student at Brown University and in the late 60s, early 70s. And this was actually when the Welfare Rights Organization was first being organized. George Wiley, there's now an institute with his name in Rhode Island. I participate in demonstrations of people on welfare to demand, you know, their rights. And this was a social movement of enormous importance in the history of this country, along with, of course, the trade union movement, the civil rights movement, and now, of course, climate justice and so forth. So I see the hope in people's movements. I do not see some hope up in the sky. I see it on the ground, and let me shamelessly borrow a slogan from Jeremy Corbyn, who's the head of the Labour Party in Britain, who may well be the next leader in Britain. And his slogan is "For the many, not the few." And that's actually from a poem by Percy Shelley, if you can look that up. I don't have the poem right in front of me, but it's a change in, let's say, emphasis on how we change things. Do we have trickle-down policies, or do we have policies that reject austerity and actually reduce income and wealth inequality, and in D.C. especially, to break down what is the reality. The reality of all of those statistics I gave you, who are most disproportionately affected? It's our African-American and brown residents. So we have a system of institutional racism, and it doesn't matter what color our politicians are. That's the reality of the system, and that's a euphemism, institutional racism. Some will call, and I think it's accurate, we have a system of white supremacy, but who is it serving? It's serving the big developers and the big bankers, most of all, and that can be measured simply by the growth in income and wealth inequality. That's the data that reflects that.
Well, you know, David,
shut up.
Well, you know what? We so much appreciate your commentary, and we've got to leave it there because we've got a lot to talk about statehood and a few other issues this week. But we appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely.
Dr. Schwartzman, geobiologist, poet laureate, great guy, and social activist, and we'll have you back again soon. Thank you so much,
David. I hope so. Thanks so much,
and thank you for your time, and again for your passion. It's palpable.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now, Maria, on to a big week in statehood.
Yay!
We have five new co-sponsors of our legislation, and guess where most of them are from?
Is it the left coast?
Yes, my favorite new state, California. Yeah,
you should make a visit out here.
Yes, in the past, and I'd love to. Yes, I should. I should come. You know,
and visit with all of the folks that have signed on.
Yeah, and now let me tell you, first of all, let me shout out to all of them. There's Representative Thomas Swoozy, who's a Democrat from New York, but also Susan Davis, who's from the 57th District of California. Salud Carbile, I'm sorry, I have a hard time with his name. He's from the 24th District from California. Dinah Titus, also a Democrat from Nevada's 1st. Norma Torres, a Democrat from California's 35th District. And Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts. So, and you know what I find interesting, and I really want your opinion on this, Maria.
Tell me.
Three of these people, the three Californians that signed on, are from Southern California. So given the fact that Northern Californians want to become a new state, and those, and they're mostly Republicans that are pushing this in Northern California, and Southern California seems to be agreeing that D.C. should be a state. Do you think this is a movement on the part of Californians? Because we have 27 California co-sponsors. That's 10 more than the next biggest state.
Do you think a lot. I would disagree with you. I think Northern California has more Democrats than they do Republican, because it's the Silicon Valley and the dot-comers, and they tend to weigh liberal. But Southern California is liberal too, because Los Angeles and Hollywood are huge bastions of liberalism.
So where are
that's why we're a blue state. There aren't any. As Senator McConnell said to me, I'm one of three from California.
Right. Which is two more than we have in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But I thought the whole concept behind the statehood movement in California to divide it up into two or three states was to give people in the Republican Party a voice, which they feel they don't have
which we don't. But I think it's because of Orange County and San Diego County, who tend to be Republican. So those are both populist counties in the state, but they certainly don't offset the rest of the state.
Right. Well, and we have that, you know, you certainly have that here in our region with the state of Virginia. You've got Northern Virginia, which is solidly Democratic, and the rest of Virginia, which is more Republican. And it's funny, you have a Republican state house and a Republican and often a Republican governor. Not now, we have a Democratic governor, but in Virginia, but nationally you have two Democratic senators, for example, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. So nationally, there's enough power in Northern Virginia in the Democratic Party to affect the national outcome, but the state itself tends to be more Republican than Democrat. And this reflects itself sometimes in the presidential race. It's a battleground state because, you know, that's when people really come out to vote, and Republicans very often take the state.
So on that note, you mentioned last week that you were going to be lobbying with Republicans.
Yes. Well, while people, and you have to give credit to all those people that went up on Emancipation Day. Thank you. If you're a D.C. resident and you're listening to this and you went out and lobbied in the House on Emancipation Day, because you got you helped get those five new Democrats. But we went to the Republicans in the Senate, and I had three meetings. I had a meeting with Tim Scott's office, and he's the Black first African-American ever elected to the Senate from South Carolina. I had a meeting in Joni Ernst's office, which is just amazing that she's the first member of Congress who's a woman from the state of Iowa. It was hard for me to believe that. She's a former, in fact, she may be in the reserves, I don't know, but she was a lieutenant colonel in the National Guard, and we had a meeting in her office. And we also met with the Republican senator from West Virginia. There's two senators, a Democrat and a Republican. So,
and how did it go? How were you received?
Well, received very well, you know, but that's politics too, right? Nobody says, I don't like you, or I'm against you, or, you know, for the most part.
Uh-huh.
And especially on this issue, because what we're talking about here is basic democracy, right? We're talking about giving people that pay taxes and fight in wars the right to vote. So there are people, when people stand against you, they stand against you, not, you know, intellectually or theoretically, they stand against you on some kind of technical issue, like you need to amend the Constitution, or you need, you know, statehood, the founding fathers didn't mean to have it this way, or whatever their argument is. But we're usually pretty well received. But I truly believe that in Tim Scott's office, especially, the legislative director that we talked to was very, very sympathetic. So I think that, you know, we need to get a Republican on the bill. And the activists are continuing to add Democrats, and that's great. But I thought, you know, we should be going after the Republicans. So that's what we're doing in the Senate, and we'll continue to do that. We tried to get Orrin Hatch to sign on because he was a supporter of a thing called the D.C. Voting Rights Act, which would have given us one vote and given Utah one vote. Also, he's about to retire. So we thought, you know, maybe he'd consider making one grand gesture before he left. But unfortunately, he doesn't want to be on the bill.
And you said that I'm sure that's because he doesn't want any controversy as he's leaving, right?
Yeah, don't know.
I mean, he's writing his legacy.
Yeah, don't know. You know what his we were hoping this would be part of his legacy, but he doesn't want to do that. And so, you know, they're never really
transparent about
what. Yeah, about it, right? You've got to kind of second guess why he wouldn't want to do it, but it's certainly against the traditional Republican. National Republican attitude about this. And again, just as a disclaimer, as a 40-year Democrat, and in deference to my co-host, let me say that if Washington were as Republican as it is Democrat, the Democrats might very well feel exactly the same way. And, you know, as a partisanship argument goes, Republicans are sure, and this may be very well the case, that we would have Democratic senators in perpetuity, and it's a delicate balance in the Senate. So they don't want to add two Democratic senators to the mix. And what we have to do is we have to push the issue to the point where they really don't get to make that choice, where people stand behind us enough that they see that it's in their self-interest to accommodate us and bring us into democracy. And maybe California, you know, maybe California is the place, right? If we can make, there are people that make the argument that we should retrocede to Northern Virginia and suck all the Democrats out of Northern Virginia. And then that would make it more palatable for the Republicans. Of course, the Northern Virginians aren't very susceptible to the
sweet on
receptive
that. I think, that there's a lot of misinformation out and ignorance, and I was one of them before I joined you on your program. And that's every time now when I read an article about elections or primaries or voting, I wonder, does this affect the District of Columbia? Because there's some movement now that's going on in the United States about the two top vote getters. And
yes, so we're off voting.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, are you guys actually able to even consider that? Were you the last?
Yes, there's actually there's actually legislation that's been proffered in the district. It hasn't passed, but to do exactly that, to have runoff voting. And there's people that push for runoff voting. I don't know how I feel about it. It's kind of a mixed bag. Progressives want to push this idea, but I'm not so sure.
It sounded kind of hokey, like the least vote getter gets taken off. And then if you had voted for that one as one of your two, then your other choice gets another vote. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it until they finally winnow it down to two.
Right. And that's a problem that I have with it. And I can tell you that we went to the Democratic caucuses in 2016. In 2016, we went to the Democratic caucuses. And that's how the Democratic caucuses work. And, you know, if in a caucus situation, it's not a bad idea, because what happens is I'm a Hillary Clinton person and you're a Joe Biden person, and you come and you go for the nomination, and Biden doesn't have enough votes to make it, but Clinton doesn't have enough votes to make it because there's another guy or another person out there that's running. So what happens is the people on for Biden and Clinton get to argue with the third person and try to convince them over to their side. And if they can do that, then they can get the nomination of that particular caucus. And it seems more reasonable in a situation where you can actually talk to people and mm-hmm. I can try to convince you. There's none of that on the ballot. On the ballot, they just go down and strictly mathematically, you were number one, I was number two, we came in this close to each other, we're going to count the votes again, we're going to do a runoff. It's nothing about trying to convince other people to vote for your candidate, so I don't like it as much as a voting system. But we're running out of time here, and one thing I want to talk about, first of all, it's Earth Day, so happy Earth Day, people. 1970, this started. Let's all, you know, as they say, thank our mother.
Hug the trees.
and realize that the climate is changing and that we're all part of the solution, right?
There's nothing political about that statement.
The climate is changing. That's right. And you know what? I was serious when I say to my kids, I say to them all the time, if there's global warming, turn the TV off if you're not going to be in that room. So, you know, we all need to do these little things to help our carbon footprint. And I'm sure we should have Dr. Schwartzman back sometime to talk about it. But let's also talk about Courtesy Week, because you and I had a courtesy expert on the show. I'm very proud of that. We're cutting edge, Maria. Yes. We're out there before everybody else.
Yes. And she is an etiquette expert, actually. The reason that I really enjoy having conversations with her is because some of the things that you and I were raised are no longer a part of society. Yeah. Like, I always remember my grandfather standing every time a woman entered a room. Yes. You know, and I mean, people would probably say that's sexist now. I don't know how I don't think so, but I just find it. I guess we should stand when an elderly person enters the room too, right? But anyway, those things that I saw growing up that are so antiquated now, what I do appreciate that we do now is that men shake women's hands, but I still get a man who will put his fingers into my hand instead of just, you know, give me his four fingers instead of shaking the hand, and I find that really awkward. But in general, I think we've lost a lot of what we used to consider common courtesy.
I agree, and I think that standing up, holding a chair for a woman, holding the door open for a woman, they're signs of respect. They're not. That's not condescending. I never saw it as condescending to women. I always saw it as respectful. And you know what? I hear a lot of women complain about the way men treat them these days, and part of it, I think, is a loss of respect. You know, I'm not a woman, so I can't say whether they've gained more or lost more in that transition in manners. But I think, you know, holding the door open for somebody says, I recognize that you're there and I'm going to hold the door open for you. Especially if you're elderly or, you know, I tell the story all the time when I was a little boy, and this is God's honest truth. I mean, 5 or 6 years old on the bus with my grandmother. And if there was a woman standing in heels riding on the bus to work, if there was a woman standing, my grandmother used to make me go up and offer my seat. And I would go up and I would tug on some young woman's dress and I would say, would you like my seat? And they would look down at me astonished even back then and say, no, thank you, sweetie. That's very kind, because I was so little. Mm-hmm. And I would have to say to them, you don't understand. I can't go back. If I go back, that crazy lady will just push me out in the aisle again and say to me, go. If I say she doesn't want the seat, my grandmother would say, go convince her.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I would have to stand next to her and make her feel guilty until she took it. You know, it wasn't an option. It was something that I was expected to do. And you know what? I am 64 years old, and I cannot sit on the subway today or on a – I don't take a bus, but I can't sit on the metro if there are women standing. I can't do it. And I don't think that's a bad thing, and I don't think it's condescending. I think it says I respect you.
I agree with you. And I do that, though. I open the door for whomever is behind me. I don't care. Right. I don't look. I just know that there's somebody behind me. Oh, and right. Or as if I'm leaving, say, the bank, I hold the door open for whomever is walking through. And when I have men do it to me, I always say to them, it is so refreshing to see a gentleman in this day and age. Thank you very much.
Well, and you know what? If I hold the door open for a woman and she doesn't say thank you, I say you're welcome.
You know? You really?
Oh, absolutely. Every time I say you're welcome. Recognize, you know, it's a two-way yes. street. Yes. I respect you. You respect me. And, you know, we should just say that Courtesy Week was started in Singapore.
I saw that.
Grew out of a thing that the Ministry of Culture started a courtesy program in 1979. So almost 40 years ago and this Courtesy Week grew out of this for people to be more courteous to one another as a way to engender social harmony. And I think it's a wonderful idea. I think that, you know, we should all stop and say how much we appreciate each other during this week and do the little things the little courtesies that make you realize that there are other people in the world. That's the problem with not having good manners, I think, is that it's so self-centered and myopic.
And you know what, you mentioned Singapore, having been there, they're called the land of rules because mm-hmm. they regulate everything,
yep.
including chewing gum.
I know.
And you could get paddled still for some things. I don't know if they actually enforce that. But I happened to be in Singapore and on public transportation. And for whatever reason, I pulled out a piece of gum. I don't usually do that. But I forgot where I was. Fortunately, there were no repercussions. But they have in some of the stores, they'll have a picture framed of all the rules that you can't do. Of course, spitting and urinating and littering. But chewing gum was one of
Well, like, there you go. Yeah. You know, if the Singapore police are out there, please don't. We will not extradite Maria. I just want yes. to tell you. We're not going to send her back.
Especially since yeah. I admitted it. Yeah. You know what? One thing they did have in Singapore, though, too, was my daughter at the time was an occasional cigarette smoker.
Yeah.
And by occasional, I mean not even daily, but usually when she had a couple drinks. And she went to buy a pack of cigarettes. And on the cigarettes, they have pictures of people with cancer and uh-huh. very graphic ones Ooh. And it in color, and she Ooh. Refused to buy a pack. That's how persuasive their marketing was.
Well, and you know what, I've always said that I was a terrible smoker. I smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes for 30 years. And what caused me to quit was just feeling stupid about it. Standing out in the rain while everybody else was inside because you couldn't smoke inside and all the other rules. So I think they're good. Well, we're out of time, Maria.
Shucks.
And shucks is exactly the way to put it. But we'll be back next week, folks. And we appreciate you listening.
As always.
I'm gonna leave you with a song about, you know, telling people that you care about them from time to time. It's by Joan Chamorro. They're a Portuguese group, and it's called I Like to Hear It Sometimes. See you next week.
I don't want to say better words, make me miss like a sweet singing bird. To be no fool, and don't treat me no special way. Just say,
I love you so.
Now and then,
I love you so.
Now and then,
I love you so.
Now
and then, in the capital of this nation, 200 years of exploitation.
the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.